Blog Talk Radio.
There's a better world that's coming, tell you why. There's a better world that's coming, tell you why. We will beat them on the land, on the sea and in the sky. There's a better world that's coming, tell you why. There's a better world that's coming, don't you see? When we'll all be union and we'll all be free. There's a better world that's coming, don't you see?
Good evening, ladies and gentlemen. It's Progressive News Network. I'm your host, Rick Spezak, News Director, here to bring you some more good news, because, friends, it is a better world to come in. And I can tell you why, because there are good people every day doing the things to make this a better world. You know, there may be people that are crabbing. There are people that tell you how bad it is. And it's true. It can be bad. It certainly can be bad. Lots of unemployed people out there, people polluting our planet, not taking care of business. But I know, because I see it every day, there are good people working every day with all of their mind, muscle, and heart to make this a better world. So welcome. And I want to ask you a favor right now first. We've got a couple of friends of the show who are under the weather right now. They need your energy. They need your thought. So please send our good friend Luis Cuevas some good energy. The man's healing. Needs some help healing. That's a good thing. And also our co-producer, Mickey Royce, is under the weather, so send her some positive thoughts, too. Let's thank Lewis and Mickey. You all get better. We need you back here helping out. Okay, thanks a lot for that. Now, some of the news coming up. Events that you should know about. Coming up in the Miami area, there is a walk for Children of Syria. That's Saturday, September 8th, at Bayfront Park, downtown Miami, by the Torch of Freedom, from 5 to 7 p.m. Make sure you check that out. We stand in solidarity with the brothers and sisters in Syria. We've got a national call-in day, September 24th. You want to call Assistant U.S. Attorney Barry Jonas to leave anti-war activists alone. This is all those activists on the West Coast, now the Chicago area, that are being persecuted, grand juried, etc., for working on world peace. Imagine that. Okay, also, another thing that cannot slip from your calendar. There's a series of book reviews by Mike Budd, distinguished FAU professor and political activist. Mike Budd will lead a review at the UUCFL, that's Oakland Park, Fort Lauderdale, of Rachel Maddow's best book, Drift, The Unmooring of American Military Power. Naomi Klein reviews it and said Maddow tells the epic story of how American warfare came to be never-ending and practically invisible. She revives a radical old-fashioned idea. Waging war should be wrenchingly difficult for a nation, for that's what prevents unnecessary wars from being waged. This courageous book deserves a spark a national debate about the purposes of war. Mike Budd is a Boca Raton resident, active with the War Versus Human Needs Truth Project. So that's 12:50, Sunday, September 23rd. And there is an Occupy Fort Lauderdale Labor Outreach Group. That's Saturday, September 1st. Okay, that was yesterday. Whoopsies. Okay, if you still haven't celebrated Labor Day, we want to make sure you do. Friday, at the there's a Labor Day in the Arts at Clay Glass Metal Stone Gallery. That's September 7th, 6 to 9 p.m. That's 605 Lake Avenue in downtown Lake Worth. Pink Slip will lead us in singing union songs. You won't get me, I'm part of the union, or she's a union maid, was wise, and the tricks of the company spies. Also, we've got a peace and music concert coming up, celebrating the International Day of Peace. That's Friday, September 21st at 7 p.m. at the Coral Springs Charter School Auditorium, 3205 North University Drive, Coral Springs. Admission is free, and that again is the 21st. And also Food Not Bombs, you know, they had a outreach and feeding out at the RNC. They're going to also be at the DNC, the Democratic National Convention. They'll be up in Charlotte feeding the hungry, something that is all part of our responsibility. So if you can help out, contact Food Not Bombs at tour, T-O-U-R, tour at foodnotbombs.net, foodnotbombs.net, or you can call them at 1-800-884-1136. I'll give you that again, 800-884-1136. Also, do not forget, put it on your calendar. If you're anywhere near Central or East Coast Florida, or even the West Coast for that matter, the Space Coast Progressive Alliance is holding their Progressive Fest, Sunday the 21st. Communities in Action, that's at O'Galley Civic Center in Melbourne. So that's the Progressive Fest. There'll be tables, all kinds of good environmental action, peace action, economic justice action. It's a really splendid festival. You got to be there. Get yourself a table. Get your group out there. There are wonderful progressives from across the state coming together for that. Make sure you be there. We'll be there ourselves. So be there. That's October 21st, Sunday from 11 to 5 p.m. in Melbourne. The Space Coast Progressive Alliance. Look it up online. Be there. Sign up now. You should be there. It's going to be a great event. And then the 27th, Realpolitik is showing a wonderful film, Koch Brothers Exposed, a screening and discussion of Robert Greenwald's superb documentary, Koch Brothers Exposed. See how much influence you could have if you only had $50 billion. You could buy your own pet politician, willing to suppress voting rights, destroy Social Security, deregulate environmental law, deny climate change, resegregate schools, corrupt education, fund extremist think tanks, determine the media news, and be responsible for illness and death of thousands by the dumping of carcinogens in disadvantaged populated areas. Okay. Problem begins at 6:15. Program begins at 6:15 with the fabulous music of Pink Slip, the singers and musician Joan Friedenberg and Bill Bowen. Visit their site at pinkslipband.com. The film begins at 7. Will be followed by an informative discussion led by your host, Rick Spezak, author, blogger, and news director of Progressive News Network. Realpolitik is a film series that addresses the need to understand the political world. That'll be at 7 p.m. sharp, Unitarian Universalist Fellowship of Boca Raton, 2601 South Andrews Boulevard. It's going to be a great event. Make sure you're there. A couple more things you should know about. We've got some news items. Again, more news than you can shake a good brain at. Okay, EFF, Electronic Freedom Foundation, sues for answers about the illegal government email and phone call surveillance. The government's withholding information about unconstitutional spying at NSA. The Electronic Frontier Foundation sued the Department of Justice, the DOJ, today, demanding answers about illegal email and phone call surveillance at the National Security Agency. The FISA Amendment, FAA of 2008, gave the NSA expansive powers to spy on Americans, international and email and telephone calls. However, last month in a letter to Senator Wyden, government officials publicly disclosed that the NSA surveillance had gone even further than the law permits. Imagine that! With Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Court issuing at least one ruling calling the NSA's action unconstitutional. The government further disclosed that FISC had determined the government's surveillance violated the spirit of the law at least on one occasion as well. EFF's Freedom of Information Act FOIA lawsuit seeks disclosure of any written opinion or orders of the FISC discussing illegal government surveillance, as well as briefing Congress about those violations. For years, we've seen news reports in the Times and other outlets about widespread government spying going beyond the broad powers granted to the FAA. We've yet to get any real answers about what's going on. Another story you need to know about. Rights groups are denouncing the dropping of all CIA torture cases. Remember, story after story coming out of Abu Ghraib, Guantanamo, Bagram, and so many more black sites about random terrorist torture of prisoners being held by the CIA and their mercenaries. The Justice Department said, hey, we can't prosecute anybody. Isn't that just fantastic? If you were a torturer, hey, no accountability here. Move along. Fact check. Ryan takes factual shortcuts in speech. I'm not even going to go over that. You know about that. You've seen the stories. Geez, you know what? Those guys weren't lying. What the hell would they say? And, of course, we actually found that out, too, because who better to interview if you don't want any facts than someone who can't talk back? I think that's why he was interviewing a chair the other night. I'll tell you, it's really too much. But ladies and gentlemen, we have a great show tonight. We've got Alphonse Mayview with SEIU and the Florida Public Service Union. And he is, I think, online right now. Let me go ahead and bring him on. Mr. Mayfield.
Yes.
Welcome, sir. Welcome. Thank you so much for joining us on this Labor Day weekend. Could you tell us a little about yourself, sir, and about the work that you're doing with the union?
Well, my name is Alfonso Mayfield. I'm president of SEIU, Florida Public Services Union. We are a public sector union that represents 16,000 employees in Florida, public sector and some private sector, which includes Head Starts, school boards, municipalities, and some transportation.
Wow. That's a lot of responsibilities there. People working to help the public every day. That's great. Thank you so much for joining us, sir.
Thank you.
Tell me, what's on your mind this Labor Day weekend here in a year when so many people seem intent on breaking unions? Give us some good news, sir.
Well, I don't know about good news. I think we're at a very critical point as it relates to the future of this country. You know, labor, the working class is what built this country. And the expanding middle class is what brought the unmitigated wealth that this country enjoyed for decades. And that's been receding. You know, some of the information that we've been looking at is Pew released a study a while ago that showed that the number of middle class Americans reduced from 61% to 51% since 1970. So it really shows that the country has been sliding backwards due to anti-worker policies. I think that getting the president reelected and getting a working Congress, a functional working Congress elected, are the first two fundamental steps to getting the economy back on track. And also trying to get work rules in place that will allow people to be able to work, to be able to earn a living wage and be able to take care of their families and send their kids to college, and also spend time with their families, because that's unbelievably important.
Well, I couldn't agree with you more, sir. You know, it seems to me that this is an absolutely unprecedented attack on the right to organize, on the right for a living wage. We haven't seen anything in this country like that since literally the beginning of the union movement. Do you see the beginnings of a pushback on this ALEC-funded, Koch brothers-funded attempt to really dismantle the unions?
Well, yes. I think that if you look at some of the work that our union and other organizations, labor and other organizations, have done, like, for example, our Fair Economy Initiative, which focused on closing tax loopholes that mostly benefited the rich but did not benefit working class, initiatives like that, are really focusing on trying to change not only the narrative but the dynamic to get people back to work, to make sure that services that people rely on every day, the elderly, everyone enjoys parks, everyone enjoys their trash getting picked up, people want clean drinking water, all those things are unbelievably important. So I think that you're starting to see that resurgence. Sometimes things don't change until it gets darkest, but we're trying to keep that from happening until it gets to that point. So I think we're at the beginning stages of that.
Well, we've seen some action from the Florida government mimicking what happened in Wisconsin, what happened in Ohio, what happened in so many other states. Some of it's been stopped, but some of it continues. I understand they're trying to, since they failed privatizing all the prisons, now they're going after prison medical care. Are you seeing that kind of attack for your union, say, in government buildings, in school facilities? Are you seeing that kind of pushback there as well?
Of course, we're seeing it everywhere, and we're seeing it under false pretenses. You know, there is an often misconception that if something's privatized, then it automatically means that the service is better, and that's completely incorrect. I mean, most of our research has found that the services that our members and other workers do in similar veins, they do a lot more with a lot less, and then there's not the whole point of a profit margin that private corporations look for. They're trying to maximize their profits. Public services and government services exist to better the public and for the public good. But, yes, there has been an unmitigated attack across the board. If you look at the history of Florida, since the Republicans took over the legislature, there has been a swift reversal where nonprofits used to fill the landscape providing services. Those nonprofits have been replaced with private corporations that have been focusing on profits. They have not delivered better service. They have delivered significantly less service than those nonprofits, though they're raking in more money and more profits. It's completely ridiculous. And so if you extrapolate that out to the future, we could be, as Americans, spending more for less, with less oversight and less accountability.
You know, it seemed to me to be the perfect illustration when they were trying to press for the privatization of the prison, saying, oh, this is going to be wonderful, this is going to be marvelous. You think, wait a minute. You know, there's a very limited number of things that are spent in prisons for the modest maintenance, for the upkeep of the buildings, for the security guards and stuff. And if you got to squeeze a profit out of that too, how is that going to be better service? How is that going to better serve the public? And when the legislators who were promoting this were asked, where's the results? Where can you see this money coming from? How could it possibly be better? They just threw their hands up because facts were not something that they were interested in dealing with.
Right. No, I agree with you 100%. I think the two biggest things that upset me about the whole prison privatization debate was the fact that there was not a clear pathway going through the normal electoral process for it to pass. That's what our democracy is about. So what does the governor do? He tries to stick it in the budget to circumvent the will of the people. That is completely absurd. The other thing was the mandate in the bill that said that the prison population would not drop below a certain level. Well, how can you guarantee that? So there's an extrapolation that goes completely counter-narrative to what government is about and what providing services to the public is about. This is all a kickback to private interests that supported the governor when he ran.
Yep. He was in the medical business, and all of a sudden we needed to start drug testing everybody, only to find that, gee, that was just another unnecessary expenditure. But it did serve his friends in the business, that's for sure.
Exactly.
Right now, are there some negotiations coming up? Does your union do – I know you mentioned schools. Is it – I guess it's Southeast Coast based – does it deal with the county schools in Broward and Dade, or what schools are you guys involved in supporting, sir?
Well, actually, we're a little bit more spread out. We are Palm Beach County School District,
uh-huh.
Glades County Schools, Lake County Schools, and Pinellas School District.
Yeah, you know, it seems amazing to me when you look at schools and how important they are, that so many of these people want to scrape out some kind of extra and think that if we suddenly add a profit motive to this, we're going to get better services. It's insane. I heard one of the Republicans, I'm a little bit further up the coast, I heard one of the Republicans, Gerald Harrell, when they were talking about slashing taxes even more for corporations, giving away new tax benefits for people who buy yachts, for people who buy private planes. And when somebody asked her, how can you continue to cut taxes on corporations and expect there not to be any fallout in public services? And she said, oh, no, we've got this all worked out. You just don't understand. There'll be no loss in services. There'll be no cutbacks in police and fire, hospitals, nothing. Nothing will suffer from these tax cuts, which, you know, was just patently absurd.
No, absolutely. I also think, you know, and I think we're finally coming to the end of this lie about this trickle-down voodoo economics that has dominated our politics since the 70s.
Let's hope so.
it is an ironic thing when David Koch, one of the major Republican backers, the Koch brothers, who are spending $400 million in this election, he even said that there's a need for the government to raise taxes because we are coming dangerously close to not being able to deliver our standards as a country. That tells a lot. When you have someone like one of the Koch brothers saying that we need to raise taxes, that should be a human cry to everyone.
Well, you know, I remember, and I'm sure you do too, when Buffett made that comment that it's insane that he pays less taxes than his secretary. And, you know, people who pay attention went, oh my God, that's insane. We all kind of had that intuition from just our own knowledge base, but to hear somebody who has the credentials of being rich say that, oh my God. But it seems that that knowledge, that awareness has evaporated once again under this barrage of propaganda coming from the Koch brothers and their fellow travelers.
No, I mean, you're absolutely correct. You're absolutely correct. I mean, I always have one question when I hear this myth about the job creators that, you know, we've had almost 8 years of so-called job creation under the Bush tax cut. So if all these job creators have been created by this gutting of the government and this explosion of the deficit through two wars and these cuts, then where are all the jobs? They aren't there because it is a myth. If companies are going to look for the most efficient way to make money and save money, which means that if they can do the job of three with one, then fine. You give them a tax break, it means that's going to be more money in their pocket. You add on top of that the subsidies that our government gives to industries like the oil industry, and it is a travesty. One of the things I hope that happens after President Obama is reelected, that these tax loopholes that Mitt Romney and others use to park money in the Cayman Islands and all overseas, which is ironic to me that there's someone who is running for President of the United States and is talking about his belief in America is using tax loopholes left and right, including some tax maneuvers like the son of the employer, which has been repudiated over periods of time, that guy is running for president. And also, you know, you look now in Bain Capital, his company is not under investigation for tax fraud.
Oh, come now. You're absolutely right. How can someone who has the kind of patriotism that means he's going to hide his money, how can that be the kind of person that they're looking for leadership?
It's a stark contrast, and I think that's the debate that we have to have as a country. You know, unfortunately, I think that this has to be an ongoing discussion post the election. Hopefully the president will get reelected. Hopefully we will get a better Congress and a better Senate. But this is a discussion that has to move on. What are the competing visions for this country? We go to early 20th century, no labor standards, no standard of living, which is what Mitt Romney is offering, or we work together as a country, as one nation, which is what made this country great, and we put people back to work, and we raise the middle class. That's the debate at hand.
That's an excellent point, sir. Let me ask you a question. It always seems funny to me that they're always ready to say that the poor have too much, that these people are being overpaid, but it's impolite to say the rich have too much. Isn't that odd?
Right. I mean, when you have millions of kids who go to sleep hungry every night, child poverty and adult poverty is at an all-time high. How can we be having a discussion about the poor having too much?
Well, it's just because they're luxuriating in their poverty.
I guess so. I was the son of a home care worker. I don't know about luxurious when your mom is working 13, 14 hours a day just to put food on the table. I don't know how luxurious is that.
I had the honor, sir, to teach briefly at the Boys and Girls Club in Immokalee.
Very good.
And, you know, I felt just a little bit good because I was trying to help out a little bit. But I felt so sad so much of the time when I was there, because working there, working in LaBelle, you see people who are having such difficulty just keeping, you know, shoes on people's feet and food in their tummies. And you know, you see driving through West Palm Beach to this community that couldn't exist without the kind of terrible labor situations we have. You know, it was a scandal in the early 60s when America noticed the plight of the migrants. But you know and I know that their lives have not gotten easier. Their lives haven't gotten better. The same kind of oppression, the same kind of terrible conditions, they remain. It's a shame. And I remember when it was so easy to say, you know, we all need to pull together, we're all working together. But boy, I'll tell you what, that seems to have been forgotten. The social contract seems to have been shredded somehow. And when I hear these right-wingers say, well, we need to have government so small we can strangle it in a bathtub. Wait a minute. Who's building the roads? Who's maintaining the churches? Who's building the schools? You know, where is the guy who's going to, you know, clean up this building at the end of the day? Who's going to run the courthouse? They just are so selfish. They do not understand. We are a group of people that needs to work together. Tell me, are there any events coming up that we should know about? Are there any union gatherings coming up we should know about?
Well, I'm sure that, you know, that there are many. I actually don't have a list in front of me. But the biggest thing that comes to mind, I think, is registering people to vote. You know, there is a large voting gap in Florida. I think 146,000 identified Republicans have been registered to vote so far, and only 11,000 Democrats. And, of course, that is a direct result of the crazy voter registration laws that were passed by this legislature who tried to limit people to vote. So the one thing I'm going to say is find somewhere to register to vote, register people at church, register people in your neighborhood. We have to take back our country. And the gift, the tool that was given to us by our founding fathers was the ballot box, and that's what we need to use to do it. If you're voting for school board, dog catcher, PTA, whatever, vote responsible people in so we can take this country in the direction it needs to go.
Excellent. Great advice, sir. Let me ask you one final question, if I may. It's a question I like to ask all my guests. You know, we're talking about the economic difficulties people have. I know my own economic situation. I have a small business, and I'm earning less today than I did when I was in my 20s. It's absurd. You know, one of the things I ask, and one of the things I'm always intrigued by, is that given that it's so hard to make ends meet, to have a roof over a family, to raise them, we still constantly find people who take from their lives time, money, resources, and they work to build a better world. What was it in your life, sir, that took you from being just another consumer, just another man who worked every day, to say you had to make time to work on making this a better world for your fellow men and women? What was it in your life, sir, that took you and brought you into the public arena?
Well, I think it was two things. I think it was my mother, who, like I mentioned earlier, was a home care worker in Mississippi, and she was someone who worked all day, and then if she had patients who used to be her patients or who just people in the community, she would go and take care of them off the clock. And that was something that she gave of herself because she cared about seniors and cared about people in the community, and also was her mother's primary caretaker to the day that she died. So that's one of the biggest things. That's something that has always been at the forefront of my mind. And my mother has always taught me that we have a responsibility not only to ourselves, but to the person sitting next to us, whether they are related to us or not. The second thing has been my faith. I mean, I am a Christian, and, you know, there is a lot of debate going on in this country about the role of a Christian. The first thing that Jesus said to me through his teachings was judge not, yet ye be judged, and to do unto others as you would have them do unto you. So I've always believed that it is my role as a man of faith to help people and to extend myself in a way that's going to help create a better world, not through judgment, not through trying to legislate morality, but by giving of myself to make the world a better place.
Well, Mr. Mayfield, sir, it has been an honor talking with you, and I hope to talk to you again soon. Keep up the good work. You know, in union we are strong, and without union we are broken and apart. And thank you so much for joining us, sir.
Yes, thank you for having me.
You come back again soon, okay?
Yes, sir.
And happy union, happy Labor Day.
Thank you.
Bye-bye. That was Mr. Alphonse Mayfield, who is a leader in the SEIU, both in Florida and internationally as well. Now, we've got some more good news. I urge you to check out the interview in Truth Out with there's John Cusack, the actor and artist, and a constitutional law professor. I'm not going to go into it on the air, but I urge you to check it out. Next up, we're going to have an interview with Dennis Campbell. Dennis Campbell, publisher and author. He's publisher of the UK Progressive. He joined us for discussions on his new book and his trip to China. Ladies and gentlemen, I'd like to welcome Dennis Campbell, international journalist, publisher of UK Progressive, a commentator and author of quite a wide selection of material. Dennis, welcome.
Thank you. Good to be here.
We're honored to have you, sir. You know, I understand you just got back from a trip to China that really gave you quite a tour. You want to talk a little bit about your trip to China?
Yeah, sure. I've been a contributor for a number of years to something called China Radio International, and I didn't even understand the scope of how large an organization this was. I had been recruited a while back, about 4 or 5 years ago, by a man that runs a program there called The Today Show, not to be confused with the one that you see with Matt Lauer on NBC, but they do a two-hour talk program on issues related to, you know, pretty much every item of politics you could imagine, and it tends to have a bit of a global focus. There's an hour-long panel, and the only problem for me is that it happens at about 2 or 3 o'clock in the morning, depending on whether the time has changed or not. And I've been probably contributing once a month or so to them for, I'd say, since the last election, and very often I get an email from them saying, can you come and be on the show? Well, apparently this one got stuck in my spam filter, and I was called by one of the people on my, you know, regular landline, and they were wondering why I hadn't responded to the invitation. And I was saying, invitation to what? And it turned out that I was being invited along with 10 other journalists and business people from around the world that were part of the English service, as well as the foreign language service and the Turkish service. I mean, they have a phenomenally huge platform there, to be part of what turned out to be an 11-day tour of the far western province in China, Xinjiang region, the Western Autonomous Region, which is an intriguing mix of cultures because of the 9 nations that border it north to south. They're bordered by Mongolia and Russia to the north, where a lot of the Uyghur people and the Russian ethnics, the Kazakhs, come from, as well as on the south by India, Pakistan, as well as Afghanistan and all the other stands that work their way around. And so the invitation was to come with them and be part of a media tour of what's called the Western Autonomous Region, which is the far western part. It's a huge geographic region. It would be roughly about a third the size of the United States in terms of total geography. It has everything from the Himalayas bordering on the south, as well as India, Pakistan, and as well as the other stands, Afghanistan, Kyrgyzstan. They have the Kazakhs, they have Uyghurs, they have people from all sorts of ethnic cultures. And it's been a bit of a melting pot, but it's also been a source of some ethnic problems in the region, because you have a lot of people that don't want to be under the rule of these ethnic Chinese. We were there for 11 days. We flew into Beijing and met the other members of the group, and it turned out all of those folks were from the Middle East. So I was there with people from Iran, Egypt, many of the countries that border that area, from Qatar to Turkey to the whole area. And it turns out you don't really know why you're invited, but it probably had something to do with my writing about the Egyptian Revolution. So we were taken by plane for 3 hours across China to the provincial capital of Urumqi, where we were welcomed and greeted by the local state government officials there. And that then led us to a number of tours of businesses, of cultural homes, and we went literally from one end of the province to another. We were in the Gobi Desert at one point, where the temperatures were 110 to 115 degrees, all the way to the top of a mountain where there was a volcanic lake, and the temperatures there were probably around about 45 to 50 degrees.
Wow.
So it was really stunning. I mean, we got to experience the culture, the foods, the different ways, but it was also a bit of a forced march. It was 16 hours a day, and we had a rough idea of what the day would entail, but we rarely spent the same night in the same hotel, and finding people that spoke English was extraordinarily difficult. But each of us had an ethnic Chinese handler who also was our interpreter, so that person was able to take us from point to point. But part of it is also, as a journalist, you're never really sure if you're getting the entire story. That's the other issue.
Well, let me ask you a question. I mean, that sounds so intriguing. I mean, about a million questions come to mind, but I'll just try to keep it to less than a dozen. My first question would be, would you think, from the overall sense of the trip, was this to show you culture? Was this to expose for economic development? Of course, it's also, whenever you invite someone, you also want to get a sense of them. But what would you say the mission of this trip was? What were they trying to show?
Well, we were greeted by the both the press minister and the cultural minister and the business development minister. So all of those people were part of the greeting ceremony, which, by the way, was on the provincial television station. So our arrival ceremony was quite ornate. We met with members of the government, who then handed us gifts, which is a tradition in that part of the world. And I think, to answer your question, it probably was a little bit of all of the above. For example, I've been able to introduce a business partner of mine in Perth, Australia, to a digital business in Urumqi that is building apps for iPhones and Blackberries, as well as a huge animation studio. And it's a business that's probably worth about $150 million, but they also have a school there, so they're training people from this melting pot of culture. So you had Kazakhs, you had Uyghurs, you had ethnic Chinese, you had people from all different regions working in their native languages, and inside of these workshops you had people working in 7 or 8 different languages, just as when we took a tour of the broadcast facilities for one of the state broadcasting televisions. We walked from department to department, each one focused on a different language and a different portion of the culture of the region. So it was really quite sophisticated and quite surprising to see, because you think you're going into a complete rural area, but in some of the big cities, the people there are actually better compensated and better trained than you would find in Beijing or Shanghai. So it really was quite interesting.
That's intriguing. Are they doing broadcast television distribution with satellites there?
Yeah, there's a lot of satellite broadcast, because, I mean, the nature of a lot of the population is not just agrarian, but they do move from place to place. They have these yurts, these tents that they build, and because the weather can be so brutal in the wintertime, they literally have to move herds of thousands of head of cattle across these trails to other more temperate areas. So you can actually see the path across hilltops where they've moved. But the funniest thing is to come into one of these yurts, and you have the compressors outside generating electricity, and sitting up on the roof is a satellite dish. So all the comforts of home, no matter where home is, I guess.
Oh, that's amazing. When you were in the Gobi Desert, did you see any archaeological facilities out there?
We did. We went into this thing called the Temple of the Thousand Buddhas, and it's a real sore spot for the ethnic Chinese and the Buddhists there, because apparently during the World War II, a number of the Japanese people that invaded that part of China actually came in and physically tore out and removed all of the Buddhas, because they were inlaid with gold. So we could see the damage that had been done in these underground caves, and you know, still very, very strong tensions. As a matter of fact, the tensions between Japan and China heated up while we were there, and they continue to this day over these disputed chain of islands. And you know, it's something that I think is going to continue for quite some time.
Well, you've got the emerging power and the fading power, I suppose, is one way to look at it.
Absolutely.
It, you know, I mean, it's so intriguing. The technology training you were talking about, animation facilities back there, I would presume they're primarily working in Asian media. But did you see evidence of, you know, doing animation for, you know, Western communications? Bart Simpson's done in Malaysia. What kind of animation were they doing there in the backside of China?
Well, you know, the interesting thing is that, you know, because that is that area of China is so close to sort of the emerging Muslim world, there were a number of characters that were created and that were then used in places like Pakistan, parts of India, and parts of the Middle East. And, you know, my business partner friend in Perth is doing some work with the Qataris. So there's a lot of tie-in because of the nature of the work they do. They were used to working in multiple languages with multiple characters.
Amazing.
We saw an animation being set up where they were literally building a papier-mâché model of an entire village over which a camera would fly, and they would use that to then develop the CGI graphic animation.
Uh-huh, uh-huh.
And they're working on everything from films to, you know, applications for tablets and telephones. So they had just opened offices in Shanghai and in Beijing. They were obviously the most impressive. There was another company we toured that was a website that was the premier website for that region, the Xinjiang autonomous, Western autonomous region, but they had like 6 million hits a day for news from all over the world because people wanted to know what was going on in that part of the country. And it was in many, many different languages, just as the others were.
And you know, it seems like the other interesting thing would be, you know, talking to some of the guests that were also on the trip with you. Was there some interesting interplay in that arena as well?
Yeah, I mean, I think, you know, the interesting thing was that, you know, myself as a very Western-looking American, my friend from Tanzania and another friend from Kenya, obviously made on the journey, were obviously African-American, or probably not African-American, but they were dark-skinned. We were in that part of the country quite the oddity, even more so for my Tanzanian and Kenyan friends, who were literally stopped by people who would pull out cameras and want to have a photograph taken with them. You know, and they just kind of shrugged their shoulders after a while. But pretty much everywhere the three of us walked together, you could see the crowds clearing on the street because they didn't quite know what to make of how we looked.
So were you a white black man or a black white man?
I don't really quite know because it was one of those situations where they don't see very many Western people. They're used to seeing a lot of Chinese. They're used to seeing a lot of people that look like them. But the three of us made quite an interesting couple, interesting trio, walking down the street together. You know, I had people, for instance, the gentleman from Egypt that was there, lovely man, a gentleman from Doha who worked for Al Jazeera. So, you know, it was really, it was something in some respects that we felt we had to just survive because the schedule was enough to kill a horse and it just about killed all of us. I was ill for 2 weeks after I came home. But now that I've had a chance to come back and look at it, I can honestly say, wow, what an experience it was to have had. Yes, I survived it, but the different cultures I saw and the array of it was just incredible.
My goodness. So were you capturing information with besides your wonderful brain, were you also doing video or digital snaps or just pen?
I probably took about 2,000 photos and I'm still going through them because, I mean, I'm writing pieces for different magazines and some of them, you know, are still embargoed and Getty is making some noises about wanting some of them. So I'd love to be able to put them all up on my Facebook page, Dennis.Campbell with one N. and someday I will. Some of them have made it onto the cover page from time to time. But I tell you, I've just hit the ground running since I've been back and haven't had a chance to really put together the kind of China notebook that I want to.
Sure, I can understand that. But, you know, I was also wondering, you know, here you're traveling in China, clearly a up-and-coming world power, and you're traveling with people who, many of whom hail from the Middle East with all its turmoil. I was wondering, the discussion ever turn on the Middle East relationship with China versus the Middle East relationship with the West?
You know, I guess because it's not so much a big deal for us, and by us I mean, you know, I've been covering the Middle East now for the last 3 or 4 years, and so I don't come at it with the same, I think, level of questioning that an average American would come at it with, because I have so many resources and sources in that part of the world, having written the book on Egypt's revolution, having followed it since, and you know, done a lot of work with various outlets there. It's not the same sort of thing. We sort of fall into more of a natural conversation. We don't have a lot of questions we ask of each other, because we pretty much all know what's going on and who's involved and what the consequences are, obviously.
Well, I just, one of the things that was crossing my mind is here, you know, we've got all this terrible saber rattling out of Israel, and I'm just wondering, you know, of all the perspectives that you hear, you don't hear too much about Asia's perspective on this this incredible you know, scorpions in a bottle sort of mentality that seems to come out of Israel.
Well, you know, China and Russia are the wild cards in all of this, because nobody knows how they're going to react. I mean, they've clearly cast their lot behind Assad in Syria.
Right. But
how they will react to anything that goes on in Iran. Iran is considered a troublemaker on so many different fronts. Nobody really quite knows how to react or deal with it. The one thing you don't hear enough of is how crippling the sanctions have been and how effective they have been. All you hear are, you know, people like Dan Senior, who, you know, got us into the mess that we're in now in Iraq, pontificating along with John Bolton and
all the
leftovers of the neocon era. When, yes, I think people need to just take a step back and have a nice, long, deep breath. Things are being taken care of, and it will move at the pace it needs to move at. You know, this whole idea of this political BS that's going on in the background all the time has just got to stop. It's not helping anybody. You didn't hear the Democrats doing any of this crap when we were in, you know, the fights in Iraq and Afghanistan. And for the Republican neocons to be pulling this crap now is just not effective. It's not helpful. And it's actually being quite harmful. You know, when a Romney goes across to Israel and basically gives them the green light to invade, speaking, you know, as an American politician, and Bibi Netanyahu is looking for any excuse to bolster his position, you then have to have the, you know, prime minister come in and say, no, wait, we don't support this, just to get Bibi back into the bottle. It's really incredibly reckless and foolish right now, and political rhetoric, people that read and hear these stories across the oceans don't understand the American political system of what goes on. They just know that, you know, if it were David Cameron and Ed Miliband, for example, the two opposing party leaders, you would not have Ed Miliband, while David Cameron, the prime minister, is out there on a global tour saying things about that particular country, nor would you have Ed Miliband making trips on his own to foreign countries discussing foreign policy. It's patently absurd. And this is what we find ourselves in with all this saber rattling. And it's such a complex issue right now with all of the parties there. I mean, Egypt is still, you know, very, very unsettled. Syria's in the process of coming apart. You've got problems now, you know, potentially in Jordan with a parliamentary collapse there with a ruler who's trying his hardest to maintain control. You've got, you know, all of these things, and Iran loves to stick its fingers in the pot and muck things up, just as they did in Iraq and just as they're going to do every place else. They want instability with Turkey. They want instability, you know, close to Israel. They want instability inside of Egypt so that they can bring a theocratic sort of a vision of the world forward. And when Romney makes statements like this, it just doesn't help.
Well, that is another kettle of fish that I'm hoping we can get to before we have to part. But speaking of Egypt, you've got a new book out.
Well, but my book is more focused. Egypt and Shackles has been out for quite some time, and we're in the process of over the next 2 to 3 months revising that book to show what has happened since the fall of Mubarak. So we're basically revising and rewriting the book so that it will show the elections, the trial of Mubarak, the new president, the reverse coup, then the coup, then all of the things that have gone on, and why Egypt is unsettled. And that book I'm hoping to have done just after the general election. What I've been focused in working on now is a U.S. political book as part of my series of books. I've now written 4 of them. The first one was just about the political process, so people could understand the process that we go through in the United States to elect a president. And then I wrote 2 books on the GOP's war on women. The first one was called The Vagina Wars.
Right.
And the second one was The Vagina Wars on Steroids, which not only talked about what was going on with women, but talked about the war and the 99%, as well as took a look at what we call Mitt's mendacity, his tendency to lie. That has now begat the 4th and final book in the series, which is one that has really intrigued me from day one, and that one is Magic Underwear in the Situation Room. That one is talking about Mormonism and its effect on this election, which is very timely. This came out a week ago. And what will Mitt be talking about on Thursday evening, of course, just before the broadcast of this program, the effect of his religion. So it's perfect timing.
Okay, I'm going to let you dive into that next, but I do want to ask one more question before we leave the Egyptian topic. There's been quite a bit of buzz, at least in those who pay attention, to some recent motions by the current head of Egypt in terms of getting rid of some generals and reaching out to the broader, trying to set Egypt with a new face in the neighborhood, it's been called. Can I get you to talk just a little bit about that, and then we'll go on to the Midster and his mendacities?
No problem at all. I mean, the problem we have now in Egypt is one of who's in charge. Just to go back, when the Mubarak resigned, the power was placed in the hands of the Supreme Council of the Armed Forces, or the SCAF. The SCAF pledged a couple of things would happen, and relatively quickly. The first of those was that they would somehow form a new parliament, so that there would be a legislative body inside of Egypt. And then the second thing they would do is they would have a presidential election. And the third thing they would do is they would put together a committee of about 100 or so people to write a constitution so that they would know how to govern going forward. Well, SCAF has misbehaved on a number of occasions. And we've pretty much come to the conclusion that they will do whatever they can get away with, wherever they can get away with it. So we've had a trial, for example, of Hosni Mubarak. He's been on death's door many times. Now he's disappeared and gone back into prison, so they say. But, you know, he was very close with the generals, but the generals did hang him out to dry. The generals were in complete control. We had parliamentary elections, and over the course of those parliamentary elections, the Muslim Brotherhood became the party with the most seats in parliament. They've very aggressively come forward and said, we now want to govern, but they saw that this was going to pose a problem for the generals in terms of their legitimacy. So just as a presidential election was about to happen, the generals disqualified or made sure that a number of candidates were disqualified from the political process of running for president. And once they were disqualified, they basically were had two choices: a former prime minister very close to the generals, or the head of the Muslim Brotherhood. When it became clear the Muslim Brotherhood was going to win, the generals feared once again they would have some problems, so they met in emergency session and passed a number of laws that basically restricted and neutered the incoming president, whoever he was. So basically the Muslim Brotherhood and Mohamed Morsi won the presidential election, but they didn't have any presidential powers. Indeed, just having the power. And then the Supreme Court decided to do what I called the reverse coup, and they said that Parliament was not properly formed and therefore is null and void and should be dissolved. The generals agreed and they dissolved Parliament. So we had a president, we had no Parliament, at least as far as they were concerned. But the Parliament still vowed to meet. They did meet for an informal session. The military did not step in or do anything. And then what happened was Mohamed Morsi came and said, okay, well, in order for us to move forward, we're going to fire Field Marshal General Tantawi, who had been, in essence, the ruler of Egypt since the 11th of February 2011, when the Egyptian government fell and Mubarak resigned. So it's complete and total chaos at this point. No one knows what the general's reaction is going to be. It's been fairly quiet throughout most of the summer. And as we come back into the fall session for just about everything else, we'll be looking to see what happens here as well.
Well, thank you. Now, I don't know, have you had a chance to follow the shenanigans in Tampa?
Oh, yes. It was, you know, fortunately for me, it happens mostly while I have normal sleeping hours. And, you know, while I was very interested in what was going on in Minnesota and stayed up till 5 o'clock in the morning, I decided to go to bed last night and relied on YouTube and the reportage of The Guardian and several others to get an idea of what actually happened. I listened to both speeches this morning. It's just insane. And it's only going to get crazier today. And I look at this election, and I think what I was most struck by was the reaction by people to Ann's speech, Ann Romney's speech, saying they wanted more about Mitt, and then how angry and nasty Chris Christie's speech was. And I still don't understand why they didn't reverse the order of those and let Ann Romney close the evening off on a high note. I mean, that what they've done is they've just opened themselves up to all of the rhetoric and the craziness that went on all day today.
Well, it's you know, there's so much to be wondering about. I was talking to another political strategist last weekend, and I said, you know, here we've got a party that's selected for its headliner, a gentleman who suggested that maybe the illegal immigrants should just voluntarily leave, which I think is one of the most curious immigration policies I've ever heard. And they've clearly gone out of their way to alienate African Americans, Hispanics, and women. Okay, so that leaves them angry old white guys.
They need 62% in order to win the election, and there's no way. That would be more than McCain got. That would be more than Bush got. So I don't get it.
Well, the only other strategy, of course, is to jigger the numbers in the machinery, and certainly, unfortunately, we can't pass on that. That's not entirely impossible. They've done it before, and of course, they've got that great Supreme Court, the best Supreme Court money can buy. But to talk for a second about Mrs. Romney, I thought, you know, if she was running for prom queen, she clearly would have, you know, swept the board. But I thought it was the most odd kind of introduction of a husband that I'd ever seen.
And then he looked like a robot being brought out on a hand lolly. trolley and deposited on stage. I mean, the guy is so stiff. I don't get it. And then even while they're listening to Chris Christie's speech, he was not even.
He looked uncomfortable.
What Chris was saying. I mean, I'm very interested to see how he pulls this off on Thursday and somehow magically, you know, steps into some sort of time machine and becomes this this humanoid thing. Because when he starts talking about his Mormon religion, I will be in rapt attention trying to listen to what he has to say about that, because this is something that is of deep concern to me going forward, is that you have a former leader in that church. Where's the separation of church and state going to be? We've already had that tested under 8 years of Bush with his Christian evangelical conservatism, and now to add in the layer of a religion that has a stated goal of leading the nation into its religion, you say to yourself, wait a minute, where's the line here? It's already been blurred, and I'm getting more and more concerned.
Well, you know, I mean, there's so much to wonder about. He has, his claim to fame is his business background, but he doesn't want to talk about business. He's a millionaire, but he doesn't want to talk about his taxes. He's ran the Olympics, but let's not talk about the fact that that's in fact a government-funded agency. There's just so much we can't talk about. I can't imagine how he could possibly, in the face of the Christian evangelical component of what's now the rabid right wing, how he could even mention Mormonism. But you think it's going to come up?
Well, I do. I mean, I was listening to Morning Joe and several of the more right-wing pundits talking today, and, you know, especially Joe, who grew up in the South, he says the evangelicals are cool with Mitt, they're cool with Mormons. I don't think so. I mean, I think that this is the smoking gun, this is the October surprise, because as people begin to read more and more about the idiosyncrasies of this religion and
baptizing
how
the dead
strange it is. I don't understand how he's going to be able to govern. He's had to spend so many weeks and months careening wildly from side to side on this roadway, to far right, to back to center, to moderate, back over to far right. This Aiken thing, I mean, there's going to be more Todd Aikens out there. There's going to be more surprises around his taxes. I mean, today, Brian Ross stepped in it again with another report, basically saying that he's got a Cayman Islands yacht where all of his parties are being held on. Well, it's not Cayman, it's Bermudian, which is another tax haven. So, I mean, the questions are not going away, and as you get closer, they're only going to get even worse. And the most surprising thing I've seen is that the mainstream media, on two occasions now, first with that brilliant rant by Chris Matthews the other day, and now a second, the National Review editor was caught in the crossfire about the blatant welfare lies and the racism behind that. So if the media finally does its job, I'd love to find a place to put David Gregory until all this is over, because I think he's one of the most ridiculous interviewers on the face of the planet. Yeah, please go ahead and talk and give me your 2 minutes of bullshit, and then we can go from there. And then thanks, that's all we have time for. I mean, it's truly astonishing that the late Tim Russert's chair has been taken over by this tool who cannot ask a tough question of anybody, and if there's anybody that needs to be asked a tough question, it's all of these blowhards on the right that are allowed to advance these fanciful themes and not ever get questioned.
Well, even I turned over to Fox to see what the right was saying about their heroes, and I caught Peggy Noonan.
Wow, isn't that amazing?
Yeah, Peggy Noonan weighing in on the Mitster's wife, and she said, well, you know, she was so perky, and that dress was just so fabulous. It's a shame she didn't tell us a little more that we didn't know. And I thought, you know, here we've got, you know, a Republican saying that the emperor has no clothes. And
basically,
where else could they get a friendlier person? You know,
Reagan's speechwriter.
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, I was stunned. I saw her comment in the Wall Street Journal. And then to take things even further, Juan Williams went off of the reservation at Fox.
I heard that.
Today. And, you know, said she looked like a corporate wife. I was like, whoa, Juan's back.
oh, it's crazy. And of course, Christy, that he is regarded as an orator of any ilk, I just find pathetic. Because if that's the level that orator is sung to, they are weaponless in a battle of wits.
And you know, it's only and the funny thing is that the Democrats have just been sitting back and letting them self-immolate, which is the smartest strategy you could ever have. And yeah, there's a few comments that come across, and they do react when they have to on clearly false stuff. But what's happening is that the independent voters are seeing these people for the complete lunatics that they are, and they're saying, my God, what the hell has happened?
Well, you know, I hope that's true, because what I'm concerned about is that those so-called low-information voters, you know, they're not picking up the hypocrisy. They don't seem to be picking up on the blatant lies. I'm just wondering if they're gonna notice that stuff at all, or are they just gonna be swallowing that Coke propaganda and it goes no further than that? You know, it just runs right off. Facts? We don't need any stinking facts.
Well, you know, this is where I've had an issue for quite some time. I said, you know, I've been telling people that are on the progressive side, don't even try to convince your Tea Party crazy uncle. Don't waste the effort, don't waste the energy, don't waste the oxygen. The argument is going to be won in the middle. It's going to be won with the independents. It's going to be won with the thinking people. And so we have to provide a thinking man and woman's argument that helps them to understand and see what's going on, which means we are going to be extraordinarily busy in the blogosphere, on programs like this, just talking about all of the issues out there, and letting people understand and see through the spin and through the lies what is really going on. And, you know, this is why I've written 4 books in 4 months, because I want people to be able to have a resource that they can go to and in the quiet of their own room sit down and go, oh, God, I didn't know that. Oh, wow, I didn't realize that was what was happening. I pull from so many different sources because I feel an obligation, and I'm going to put those 4 together into a book called Billionaire Boys Election Freak Show, and they'll be able to get them all in paperback as well as in the electronic format for Kindle and the like, because I want the voters to be informed of a progressive viewpoint that may get lost in this corporate media. And the more pressure we put on corporate media to do and cover stories, the more we're going to see like what's starting to happen with people calling out the lies as they see them. The fact-free GOP universe cannot be allowed to function. And I keep going back to religion. I don't care what your religion is. I don't care that he's a Mormon. I do care that this man has spent his life in leadership roles inside the bowels of that church. And wasn't it in 1960 that we had a huge issue with, you know, at least on the right side of would John F. Kennedy as a Roman Catholic be taking his orders from the Pope? Well, this is far worse. This is somebody who's been in the inner circle for a very, very long time of leading that church. And I don't like having that person with a finger on the button, finger on the pulse, in such a powerful position where a religious view could somehow be brought into what should be a secular discussion of where the nation is headed and what are the things we should be doing.
Well, before I let you go further in that direction, and I'm going to let you run with that your new book, Magic Underwear in this Situation Room, I want to ask one other question. You know,
yeah.
Under the heading of With Friends Like That, now, the Republican Party has some really interesting friends. You know, with Mr. Adkins' remarks the other day, he opened up a whole new front in the battle of the sexes all by himself. And with so many other prominent GOP voices you know, hidden away, they're going to be called on to comment, and I can't imagine that one or two of them are going to be slipping with a little bit of truth out there. What was your reaction to the Adkins comment?
Well, I mean, I thought it was just disgusting. It was despicable. It was everything that you could possibly think it was. I actually saw it almost moments after it broke because I was looking at the headline on Talking Points memo, and as it literally happened in the middle of a Sunday afternoon, your time, or very early actually, I think it was on a morning program, and I saw Talking Points memo break the story because I have an alert for when they have something, and I went, uh-oh, this is not going to be good. And you could literally, like dominoes, watch the news organizations pick it up one by one by one. By the time you got to 8 or 9 o'clock at night, your time, I mean, it was an absolute inferno. And I loved the story that Rachel Maddow did, showing the timeline of when people reacted and when they said he had to go. You know, it was such a horrific gap. But the sad thing is that this is how he and a very large percentage of that GOP conservative Tea Party Republican gang cabal feel about these issues, that no one is going to be able to distance themselves from the record that they've held on this. So it's really going to be interesting to watch. I mean, already Ryan is you know, contorting himself into 15 different positions, trying to distance himself from his budget, his position on Medicare, and his position on abortion, and he's not being successful at all.
Well, you know, he's one of the co-sponsors with Adkins of a personhood amendment for raw genetic material.
And here, you know, and I've been interviewed a few times, like another couple more coming up next week here in the UK. I'll literally have the commentator or the interviewer look at me and they'll say, "What the hell is going on?" Because here in the UK, and I mentioned this because, you know, I do that weekly thing for the David Pakman show. You know, what I decided to do was be a bit proactive because David and I planned to do something, and we did it last Thursday, on this issue of Paul Ryan. I went out and I talked to the people that normally hire me to come in as a commentator and a pundit, and they were all saying essentially the same thing. They said they couldn't understand how the race for the U.S. president had become so ideological. I mean, we have debates here, left versus right. They don't like each other. They attack each other. But nobody on either side would consider doing away with the National Health Service or the welfare system or the things that are needed when people have difficulties in their life. It's just beyond the pale. And to have all of these ideological issues that are religious and abortion-based be foremost in the minds and in the discussion of the debate, you find that most of the commentators or the people who hire commentators here just cannot put their arms around it. They find themselves thinking, how did this happen? How was this allowed to get to this point?
Well, not to mention the anti-science bias of so much of this.
Oh, well, I mean, that's another piece of it. I mean, my wife laughs at that one all the time. She says, you know, we were having dinner with the kids and said, yeah, she said, more than half the people in the United States believe the Earth's only 6,000 years old. And my kids, who are, you know, in their teens, look at me as if to say, what? You know?
Yeah.
What planet are these people on? Because, I mean, they've grown up in an educational system here that says, hey, there's all sorts of theories out there, but science is science.
Yep. So you've done some research on Mormonism and its power structure, Mormonism, and its relationship to, I guess, end times, its relationship to how it wants to see government. I mean, anybody who knows that the reason that Mitt spent some time in Mexico because his ancestors fled because they were polygamous. How do you see this impacting a Mitt Romney, Paul Ryan regime in the Pentagon, in the White House, in the Situation Room? How do you see this this impact?
Well, I mean, I want to go back to what I said sort of at the start of this thing, that you know, your religious choice is your choice, and if you have found something that you know is important to you and in your life, God bless, more power, off you go, have a great time. I don't want to be involved in any situation where someone is told you can or cannot do this. I mean, I think one of the principles of the founding fathers of the United States was this whole issue of separation of church and state, because the founding fathers themselves fled severe religious persecution in their own land. I understand the trek of the Mormons. It's really, you know, admirable that they were able, after the death of Smith with Brigham Young, to make their way all the way across the country and, you know, across the Rocky Mountains in the mid-1800s and establish their outpost and to do what they wanted to do there. That's all within their rights to do that. What I have a problem with, and I don't care what religion it is when people begin to start proselytizing and telling me what I must do in order to achieve salvation. There's no coincidence that there are 55,000 missionaries out there in this religion. Yes, on the one hand, they are trying to grow the religion and grow the flock. On the other hand, I have serious concerns when people come and knock on my door, whether it be Mormons, Muslims, Jehovah's Witnesses, whatever, trying to tell me the good news about their religion. You found something that works for you, God bless, go forth, multiply, be fruitful, do whatever you need to do to find peace within yourself. Just stay out of my life, okay? I'm happy with where I am. I think a lot of people feel that my religion and my business is my business and not yours. Where I have concerns, and what, as I began to study, and I was very fortunate to have the commentary and assistance of a guy on Twitter who runs something called Mormon Dems, Mormon Democrats. He's also got a nice blog out there. His name is Matt Anselmo. He's a really good guy. And we had some very spirited discussions that went back and forth. And what I liked about him was that you asked him a question, you got an answer. Then you got a second answer that kind of shaded things a little bit to give a bit of an historical perspective as almost a justification and a communal kind of guilt assuaging thing. So, you know, I would ask him a question about, you know, certain aspects of the religion. He would say, for example, polygamy was completely outlawed, it's against the rules, cannot be done, blah, blah, blah. But then he'd come back with the second half of the answer, which I thought was very interesting. He would say, but weren't there a lot of polygamist sort of cultures in all religions? And he'd start to list them one by one by one, as if to somewhat justify the fact that it might have happened in the past but doesn't happen now. Now, I'm not reading any more into it than just what he has said. As he began to give me answers about the roles that someone like a Mitt Romney played in the church, first as a lay bishop. Well, I was a lay reader in a branch of Protestantism, and, you know, every so often you're asked to go up and read a piece of scripture from the podium, etc. I know what a lay bishop is. A lay bishop, they keep trying to say, is the lowest leader in the church. He's someone that works with, you know, a local church or a local temple and has no authority, they go to great pains to say, in the broader aspects of the church. The next step, though, is the stake leader. And this is what Mitt Romney did in Massachusetts. Basically, all of the churches and temples in Massachusetts reported to Mitt. He was required to spend 30 hours a week working on church-related issues. Now, by most accounts, he was very good at what he did. He helped the church. He helped to grow the church. And there are also some areas in which we've read about in the newspapers, we've read about in reports, where advice was given that was strictly doctrinaire and followed a certain method of teaching within the church that perhaps was not necessarily in the best interest of the person that it was being provided to. My point and my question is, what do you do when a former bishop then stake leader
is now running for the highest political office in the United States. Everybody can sit there and say, oh, poo-poo, it won't affect him. He's not going to be like that. Even Matt did the same thing. He said, you know, I've had stake leaders who were, you know, chemists who, one guy ran a store, one guy did this. They're all good people. And what do you do when you're in that powerful position? And what impact does that have in the broader message going forward? These are questions that have not ever been asked. President Obama's team cannot ask them because that's the third rail. You touch that, you die, because the right wing will come down on top of him and the campaign with full force and fury. So he doesn't go there. Other people need to go there. They need to ask these questions. They need to delve deeper into the relationship, the prophecy, and all of the things that this church says it wants to accomplish, because some of the historical stuff is pretty scary. Is that still being used today? Is this where they're trying to head? I don't think, as you know, an American abroad, I want to see the leader of the United States of America, the President of the United States, also having such a significant role in any religion. It was bad enough under 8 years of Bush watching what that did. I don't want to see that happen again with something even less stable in the longer run.
Well, this was an absolutely amazing interview, Dennis. Thank you so much. The book is Magic Underwear in the Situation Room?
Yes, and it's on the Kindle store. It's like all my other little books. They're short. They run about 60 to 70 pages, and you know, $2.99, well worth spent. You know, you can't buy a pint of beer for that here. So.
Well, thanks again, Dennis.
And you can get more out of it. I want people to have the opportunity to get that message out there.
Well, and I hope you enjoy tonight's festivities at the Republican convention, and may more and more Republicans accidentally speak the truth. It couldn't happen to a nicer bunch.
Thank you, Rick, and it's always a pleasure to talk with you.
Likewise, my friend. Bye-bye. Okay, that was Dennis Campbell, a publisher of UK Progressive and author with several interesting tales from his recent adventures. Another story I want to bring to your attention, this is from Truth Out. It's entitled, Why Are We Turning Our Backs on the Constitution? It's been nearly 4 years since President Barack Obama promised to close the detention camps at Guantanamo Bay. The camps remain open, along with a score of lingering questions. August 20th, like so many observers before me, the author boarded a flight at Andrews Air Force Base. This is by Jenny Carroll of Truth Out. Boarded a flight at Andrews Air Force Base in hopes of witnessing the military commissions in action, ostensibly. She was going to watch a series of hearings over a 9-day period involving motions in the 9/11 conspirators case, and while Mother Nature had other plans, the hearings were canceled thanks to the imminent arrival of Tropical Storm Isaac. The motions filed give some indication of the hard road ahead. The motions fall into several categories, but are unified by a central theme. Can justice be achieved in a system besieged with allegations that it's shrouded in every sense in secrecy and inequity? If transparency and the ability to engage in zealous advocacy is a currency of legitimacy in Article 3 civilian courts, how can these commissions, with their presumptive classifications, requirements of the defense to seek aid and approval of the prosecution procuring witnesses, and wildly disparate resources between the two sides, possibly produce anything resembling a fair conclusion? Or are the proceedings an entirely different animal in which the proper comparison is to court-martial proceedings and not to civilian courts at all? This question invariably haunts the hybrid system Congress created. In rejecting both Article III court system and the court-martial process, Congress created a no-man's land of judicial uncertainty and procedural limbo and left these commissions to sort out the appropriate processes for these cases. As Judge Pohl and the litigants struggle to define the proper procedure in this hybrid system, the motions filed in the last few months push the questions of the process's legitimacy to the foreground. I want to leave you with those thoughts and urge you to take a look at Truth Out for that article, Why Are We Turning Our Backs on the Constitution? Another story I want to bring to your attention on the fracking front, and this is from Truth Out also. Biologist and writer Sandra Steingraber invites fellow activists to pledge nonviolent resistance to fracking in New York State. Dateline, Albany, August 27th. On this day, a pregnant college student walked into a hospital in rural Illinois and gave birth to a child. Then she walked out by herself. The baby she left behind was a ward of the state. 3 months later, a family was found for it. That child was me. This story carries three messages. The first is for Governor Cuomo. At the Democratic Committee Policy Conference last week, the governor affirmed his belief in the essential value of government, calling it the vehicle for the community. I am Exhibit A for that noble idea. Sometimes a vehicle for community means finding a home for an abandoned child. Sometimes a vehicle for that community means saying no to a carcinogen-dependent industry that seeks to use our towns as their factory floor, offering temporary riches for a few and permanent pollution for all. Governor Cuomo, the state of Illinois once protected me. Now I want you to protect my two children. Governor Cuomo says no. The second message is to the gas industry. Your representatives follow me around to speaking events across the state, post reports about me. You've commented on my makeup, my emotional life, my cancer diagnosis, the size of my house, which is 1,218 square feet. I learned that from reading the Energy In Depth blog. Hey, gas industry, I'm not afraid of you, and that's not because I'm fearless. It's because I'm so scared for the future of my children on a fracked up planet that I have no fear left over for you. So let me tell you about my last name, which you mocked in a recent column. It belongs to the man who took me in when I had no home, a man who fought against Hitler's army when he was just a teenager, a man who taught me that when you carry around a name like Steingraber, you can't act like a good German. You stand up against bullies and you never, never give up. Memo to the gas industry, I'm a biologist, and I'll debate you on the public health effects of fracking anytime, anywhere. Back off my dad. The third message is for all of you. There's a lot of crappy things about being adopted and having no ancestors, but the gift of it is you can choose your own tribe and choose your own homeland. I chose to belong to this place in this moment, which represents the birth of the greatest human rights movement in New York State since abolition and suffrage. I chose to belong to a vision of an unfractured New York that turns its back on 19th century thinking and death-dealing fossil fuels and leads the world in the creation of a clean energy economy. Are we united in this belief? Are you ready to pledge your resistance to fracking? Okay, friends, let's rock this thing. Oh, and thank you for making this the best birthday of my life. Here's how it's going to work. I'll recite the preamble, the pledge to resist fracking, and then the baritone voice of Mr. David Baum will swear us all in Occupy style. 3,200 people have already signed the pledge. We'll be delivering these signatures to the governor immediately after. If you want to sign the pledge and haven't done yet, go to don'tfracknewyork.org. That's don'tfracknewyork.org. And add your name. And then you can become an ambassador for the pledge and introduce it to your friends and neighbors. Many people helped write the pledge to resist fracking in New York State, and it's gone through many iterations. I was tasked with writing the first draft, and I've never had a more weighty writing assignment. This pledge is a solemn commitment that calls us to a peaceful, nonviolent protest as our conscience leads us, as in the case of Governor Cuomo approves fracking for any part of New York State. As a writer who believes in the power of words, it's my fervent hope that these words will reveal the depth and breadth of the opposition to fracking in New York State and lead Governor Cuomo to the exit door. I hope the pledge can change the course of Providence itself, and we'll never have to activate it. I don't want anyone to get hurt. I don't want to fill jail cells with good people. I don't even like confrontation. But if we have to activate this pledge, if it turns out that I can be a better parent inside jail than outside, I'll be that parent. If we have to lay our bodies down, I promise you I'll be there. That's by Sandra Steingraber, an ecologist, author, cancer survivor, and currently a scholar in residence at Ithaca College in Ithaca, New York. Friends, if you've ever seen those images of water coming out of a faucet and being lit on fire, then you know what fracking's about. I don't have a Fukushima report this week, but we're going to make up for it next week. We have an all-environmental show next week. Make sure you tune in. Thanks so much for joining us. I want to thank you on behalf of myself, my co-producer, Mickey Royce, who's under the weather. I want to encourage you to listen to all the good progressive broadcasters out there, Gwen Holden Berry and Here Be Monsters, Brian Stetton, Progress Toward Democracy, Susan Nylon of the Susan Nylon Report. Make sure you tune in, support the progressive activists out there. We're going to make this a better world, that's for sure. We'll see you next week. Thanks so much. On behalf of myself, News Director Rick Spezak, I want to encourage you to tune in next week. From Progressive News Network, thanks so much.
They used to tell me I was building a dream, and so I followed them all. When there was earth to plow, a gun to bear arms was always there, right on the dark. You should tell me I was building a dream, with peace and glory ahead. Why should I be standing in line, just waiting for prayer? Once I built a railroad, I made it run, made it race against time. One side of the railroad, now it's done. Brother, in paradise. Once I built a tower, up in the sun, brick and rivet and mud. Once I built a tower, now it's done. Brother, in paradise. One thing Maggie Sue, she did a swell, full of that Yankee doodly-doo. Half a million fools went slugging through hell, and I was the kid with the drum. Say, don't you remember? They called me Al. It was all the time. Why don't you remember? I'm your pal. Say, buddy, and he's paradise. One thing Peggy Sue, ah, she was a swell, full of that Yankee doodle-dum. Half a million fools went slugging through hell. And I was the kid with a drum. Oh, say, don't you remember? They called me Al. It was Al all the time. Say, don't you remember? I'm your pal.